Okay, so let us continue where we left off this morning. And so far we have been looking at the first four factors of the Noble Eightfold Path, here represented as the gradual training. We had a look at just right action and right speech. And now we come to a little paragraph that has to do with contentment. And contentment here is very similar to the idea of right livelihood on the Noble Eightfold Path, because the contentment here refers to how you kind of how you survive as a monastic. And for a monastic, that also implies the idea of being content. So here we have, this is slightly different from how it is normally described on the Noble Eightfold Path, where there are certain occupations that are considered wrong or not according to the Dhamma, but here it's more about how to be content. And what is interesting about this, the idea of contentment, is that now we are kind of moving from actions of body and speech, and we're moving into the mental realm. When we are content about things, it means that the mind is starting to settle down. The mind is kind of being happy with what you have. We are reducing desires and ill will already at this point. So, a desire and aversion. This is already being reduced quite strongly when you are content with the way things are in the world. So we're moving into the realm of the mind at this point. And this is the first kind of step of that moving in, of working with the mind to be content about how things are. And for the monastics, of course, it is quite simple, as we shall see in a second. Or at least ideally, it is quite simple. The reality is sometimes not quite that simple, but ideally it's quite simple. But it's not just for monastics. This is, of course, for lay Buddhists as well, or for anyone really. The idea to be content with what you have. One of the interesting things, of course, is how can you be content with things in this world? And again, it's a matter of wisdom to be wise about what really matters in life, to be wise about where you should put in your effort and what actually is important. That's really, where so many of these things come from, this wisdom, understanding of things in the right way. The opposite of contentment is always to seek things, always seeking more wealth, seeking more possessions, seeking things in the material realm. Or it could mean seeking things in the psychological realm, seeking position, seeking advancement in your career, seeking relationships, whatever it is, all of this kind of stuff. And the opposite of that is just to be content with what you have. Not really try so hard. It doesn't really matter. Whatever I have is good enough. Don't really want to go anywhere else. And instead, be more ambitious in the spiritual realm, if you like, rather than the material realm. So understanding, right, that these things are never really going to give satisfaction. If you have some success, it is going to be more success to be demanded from you afterwards. There's no end to things in the worldly realm. There's always more things to be had, more things to be pursued. Desire is never fulfilled by seeking the object of the desire. The desire is fulfilled by finding meaning somewhere else and finding contentment, basically. That is where these things are desired. And by thinking like that, you're kind of satisfied with your lot in life. Okay, this is what I have, right? Now let me kind of pursue things in a different way. So it's a wisdom aspect of the path, this idea of contentment. So let us have a look at this. See what the Buddha has to say about this. I have skipped a little passage there. You see the little dots means that I have taken out a passage, which wasn't that relevant, I felt. That's why I took it out. It's a bit about kind of minor rules for monastics about not accepting slaves and meat and raw grain and kind of slightly things that aren't that interesting, basically, that I took out there. So this is what the Buddha has to say. He becomes content with robes to protect his body and with alms food to maintain his stomach. And wherever he goes, he sets out, taking only these with him. Just as a bird, wherever it goes, flies with its wings as its only burden, so too the bhikkhu becomes content with robes to protect his body and with alms food to maintain his stomach. And wherever he goes, he sets out, taking only these with him. Yeah, so that is the kind of the ideal of the monastic life. Very simple. And there are, even in the present day, you'll be surprised, there are monastics who live pretty much up to this ideal. There is one very famous monk who used to live in Sri Lanka. He was German-born, but he lived in Sri Lanka for a few decades. His name was Venerable Ñanavimala. And many people thought he was an Aryan. Some people said he was an Arahant and all of these things. And he spent about 30 years in Sri Lanka just wandering around and with his robes and his alms bowl and nothing much more than that. Just wandering around the island, finding suitable places to meditate. And that's how he lived his life. And when Ajahn Sujato, he left for Taiwan a year and a half ago or something. When he left for Taiwan, he left with his bowl and robes and a shoulder bag. And that was all he had when he left. That was all his possessions in this world. Right? It's quite nice. You just leave with that. Have nothing more. It makes life very light and easy. And this is, for the monastics, actually, it is almost, you almost have to become content with little, because you are not, according to the monastic rules, you cannot really ask for very much. You can't say to the lay people, oh, I want this food, I don't want that food, you know, or I want robes like this, I want kind of designer robes or whatever, but that's not gonna wash, right? Or I want a really large house to live in, I don't want these kind of tiny little cuties, or whatever it is. You can't ask for these things. You're not allowed. You're supposed to take whatever you get. And after a while, you get used to that. And when you get used to that, you don't really look for anything anymore. You just kind of go around and you're happy with whatever you have. Most of us, if we really were interested in nice things, we would be lay people, because we could have much more of that as a lay person anyway. You know, and for that reason, it kind of becomes pointless to look for nice things in monastic life. It kind of completely becomes very silly, in fact. That is the nice thing about monastic life. You just don't really think about that anymore. You just go about your day, whatever people bring you. Ajahn Brahm always says that at the Bodhidharma Monastery, we have seafood. Why is that? Because what you see, that is what you get. That means contentment, right? You are content with what is there. And then you have this beautiful simile of this monk or nun, just like the bird flies with its wings as its only burden. The wings are kind of still a bit burdensome, but basically a bird is very free. You see a bird, I don't know if you remember that, there was a book back in the early 80s called Jonathan Livingston Seagull, which was about this bird that was flying and kind of trying to kind of break its, do things its own way and break out of the crowd. And this freedom of the bird is flying here. And in the same way, there's a sense of freedom when you have very few bindings in the world. You just wander around. You're free, just like your bird is free in a sense. And when you do this, when you live contented in this way, what happens? And then it says that possessing this aggregate of noble virtue, that is what they call the Buddhist hybrid English, the aggregate of noble virtue. Is not real English. It's not something you find anywhere else except for in the Buddhist suttas, Buddhist hybrid English. Anyway, so when you have this aggregate of noble virtue, he experiences within himself a bliss that is blameless. So aggregate of noble virtue just means all these virtues of these various kinds. And it's noble, right? It's kind of an uplifting idea. If you practice in this way, you are noble. You're practicing the noble way of noble virtue if you do these things. Isn't that this? But the Buddha is telling you that. It's not, you don't have any choice. You might feel like, oh, I don't feel really noble. But there you are. You are noble if you do this, whether you want to or not. You are noble. So this is the what happens when you practice in this way. It's nice. It's a very nice little adjective there to add. And when you do that, you experience within yourself the bliss of blamelessness. Because you are blameless, there is a bliss, the happiness, the sukha that comes with that. That bliss is precisely the kind of bliss that we are trying to develop on this Buddhist path. The idea that when you live well, you do the right things, you tend to feel good about yourself. You feel happy with your conduct, happy with your life. You don't blame yourself in any way. In fact, you feel bright inside because you know that you're living in the right way. And this is that bliss. It's the bliss that you have when you sit down on a meditation seat and you just feel good inside of yourself. There's a nice simile, which I don't know, I haven't used it this time, but there's a nice simile in one of the suttas in the Majjhima Nikaya, in the middle length sayings, in the Majjhima Nikaya 129, the Bala Pandita Sutta, the fools and wise people. In that simile, it talks about the various benefits of virtue. And if you live very virtuously, if you have a really good character and a good heart, it says that when you come back home in the evening, after a long day, you've been working hard, doing all kinds of things, you're perhaps physically a bit tired because of all the hard work, and when you sit down or you lie down just to rest and just to chill a little bit, then you feel all the goodness, all the good actions that you have done, they come back to you. And they come back to you and they envelop you. They you're completely immersed in this good activity here. And because of that, you feel happy here. You feel joyous. And it says, it's a simile of the mountain. It's just like when there is a mountain and there is a house on the mountain slope. And then the sun, the house is on the eastern side. And the sun goes down in the west. And when the sun goes down in the west, that house is completely enveloped and immersed in the shadow of that mountain. There's no part of that house that isn't completely immersed by the shadow. In the same way, you are immersed in your good actions. You feel kind of your good actions having completely, immersed in those good actions. You can't escape them. You can't avoid feeling good about yourself. Can't avoid being happy. And this is the ideal way of doing, when we talk about doing the sila and sati, the recollection of virtue and character, and sila on the Buddhist path. This is the ideal way of doing that. You sit down and you don't really have to recall very much. You just know in your heart from the beginning that you are doing things in the right way. And then you do the actual sila nusati as recommended by the Buddha. We'll have a look at that later on just to give it a little bit of boost. But you don't have to do very much because you're already in the right mind space. You already are there where you're supposed to be. And then there are no bad actions that you regret, that kind of hold you down. Yeah, that bad actions hold you down. It's like your mind is being suppressed and held down. It's like if you imagine it. A helium balloon, right? A helium balloon, you have all these sandbags and all these ropes that peg you to the ground so you can't kind of just fly off. And all the bad activities are like these sandbags and the ropes that peg you down to the ground. And the good activity is like the helium, right? You fill more helium into that balloon. The less you have of the sandbags, the less you have of the ropes pegged to the ground, the more helium you have, the more you're going to soar, you're going to be light, you're going to kind of float up like a balloon. And this is what it feels like to be good. It feels light. It doesn't feel heavy. It feels light. It feels mindful. It feels glad. All of these good qualities. It feels energetic. All of these good things coming together. So this is the bliss of blamelessness. The Anavajja Sukha in Pali. Vajja is a blame. Sukha is any kind of happiness. The bliss, the happiness of being blameless is what this is about. So you can see, and this is here, we have this very starting point of happiness on the Buddhist path, and then the happiness just grows and grows and grows. With every kind of factor we're going to look at, the more happiness you have on the path, and the more you kind of lift it up you feel as a consequence. So that is the little paragraph on contentment and to just be satisfied with the way things are in life, not to seek too much and to make sure that we kind of look for things in the right area of life. And then contentment happens as a consequence. And so now we are kind of moving into the area of mind, how to deal with the mind itself, how to calm it down, to make it more even and not so kind of up and down, jumpy as it often is. This is the first step on that. And the second step of dealing with the mind comes next. And now we are firmly moving into the area of right effort. So we have now already come to the sixth factor of the Noble Eightfold Path. And I want to spend quite a lot of time on this idea of right effort. Because this has all to do with how to deal with the mind, how to ensure that we make the most out of this spiritual life. Of course, it is always when we if we try to live in the right way by body and speech, but the mind is still impure, it can make it harder, because the mind is always going to pull us one way and our ideal is going to pull us a separate way. So if we can deal more with the root cause of the problem, deal directly with the mind is often much more efficient. Yeah, so we go back to the root cause of the mind, and then we kind of, everything else tends to fall into place as a consequence. And a lot of this that we're going to look at now has to do with being wise about things, using wisdom power, as Ajahn Brahm put it, rather than willpower. And all of this is really how to use wisdom in the right way. And there is a nice little sutta. Again, I don't think I have. Have I? Is it included here? Let's have a quick look. Can't remember. Oh yeah, it is included later on. So I'll just leave it till later on, perhaps. Actually, might as well say that, bring it out now. It is a sutta which comes next. It's called the Sutta on the Two Powers. And it's the next sutta in this whole thing here. And I'm not going to read it out because it's fairly straightforward. But the idea of this sutta is that it says that there are two kinds of powers. This is from the Anguttara Nikaya. There are two powers. One is called the power of reflection, and one is called the power of development. Reflection, patti sankhana in Pali. Development is bhavana. So what are these two powers? And these two powers are, on the one hand, the power of overcoming all the unwholesome things by body, speech, and mind. Yeah. The power of doing that is the power of reflection. So if you want to be virtuous, if you want to do the right thing, if you want to even think the right thoughts or perceive in the right way, the way to do that is the power of reflection. It's not the power of development, it's not the power of meditation or developing your mind, it's actually about how to reflect in the right way. And the power of bhavana, which is development, that is the development of the samadhi. Here it is specifically said the seven factors of awakening. That's all to do with meditation practice. So that's very interesting, because what it means is that first of all, you get your sila into place, including how you think about things. Then when the sila is ready, then you are ready to do meditation practice. But the sila is not really developed by meditation, it's developed by how we think about the world. So if you want to purify yourself, if you want to learn how to think in the right way, to have a pure mind, that actually happens through how we think, how we reflect, rather than how we meditate. Of course, meditation can be a little bit of a support for that, but meditation in itself, just watching the breath, is not going to be sufficient. The real way of dealing with this is how we reflect about things. So that is a very interesting point that I think sometimes isn't quite appreciated on this Buddhist path, the importance of learning how to reflect and think and contemplate in the right way here. If you do that, that is how the sila is established properly here. And then the meditation arises from that, then the bhavana comes. So for that reason, this idea of using wisdom is so important on the Buddhist path. And it's such this is one thing I will show you on a few different occasions here as we go through this, how precisely that first of all, that it is the case that wisdom is important, and then how it is done afterwards. So the very first, this is here on the Noble, in the gradual training, it is expressed through a well-known formula on sense restraint. Sense restraint is the Indriya Sangvara Sila in Pali. And this is what is coming up now, the restraint of the senses. And the idea of the restraint of the senses is to keep an even mind in life, which isn't kind of so jumpy up and around all the time. So let's see what this little passage on sense restraint has to offer us. So, on seeing a form with the eye, he does not grasp at its features and signs. Since if he left the eye faculty unguarded, evil, unwholesome states of covetousness and grief might invade him. He practices the way of his restraint. He guards the eye faculty. So what does this mean? And what it means is actually quite simple. It may not look all that simple when you read it. It looks kind of rather a little bit strange, even all this. But actually, the message here is actually fairly straightforward. So you see a form with the eye, right? You can't avoid that when as long as you see stuff. That's basically what it means. That maybe that's a better translation. You see stuff, because when you see things. You do not grasp at its signs and features. Signs and feature just means you don't grasp the object itself, or you don't grasp any particular aspect of that object. You don't grasp the object or its aspects. That's really what it means. Yeah, so what does it mean that we grasp something? In what sense do we grasp something that we see? And we grasp it, of course, what it means here. It's metaphorical grasping. It's a mental grasping. You see something, and then the mind holds on to that. And the way you know that the mind holds on to it is because you can't let go of it. It sticks in your mind. You see something that is nice, and your mind keeps on thinking about it afterwards. And when you keep on thinking about it afterwards, instead of just going with the flow, going on to the next object or whatever, it sticks in your mind. Or it sticks in your mind in a negative sense. You don't like it, and you feel a sense of aversion. And again, it sticks in your mind after you have seen it. Yeah, that's another way. That's a kind of negative grasping. And negative grasping is just as, maybe even more bad than the positive grasping. So you hold on to it. You can't let go. And that is what destroys our mindfulness. If you want to be mindful, you have to go with the flow. You have to be aware of what is happening now. You can't just hang on to things that have already passed. Yeah, that is what is the ideal here. You don't want to grasp onto things. You don't want to cling onto them because of desires and aversions to these objects. The underlying tendency to desire and aversion is always there. Except if you become an arahant or anagami, whatever, it's always there. So we have to always watch out, because these things arise suddenly, bang, and there you are. Something has arisen in your mind. And of course, the main thing here, the main problem, the main form that kind of gives rise to these things in us, of course, is other people again. Other people is often the thing that causes most problems for us in our life, in terms of both desire and also in terms of aversion. Other things, of course, as well, but people is kind of top of the list. So that is what it means, right? You do not grasp things in that way. Why do we not grasp it? Because if you leave the eye faculty unguarded, it says here, evil, unwholesome states of covetousness and grief might invade him. Evil, unwholesome states. Okay, so evil here, papa in Pali, basically it means bad. Evil is a kind of very Christian term. It means bad, bad things. Unwholesome, akusala, right? Unwholesome, unskillful, perhaps. Unskillful is another translation of this word. In other words, it leads you down the garden path in the wrong direction. It is unhealthy in the sense of being unwholesome. And states here, papa akusala dhamma. Dhamma really means qualities of the mind. Yeah? When you hear the word states, it sounds like something that is almost permanent. It's a state of the mind, something that is there. But it really just means the fluctuating qualities of the mind that are always kind of moving around. So bad, unskillful, or unwholesome qualities of covetousness and grief. Now that is a very bad translation. If there ever was a misleading translation, that would be one of those misleading translations. And I really respect Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi for his translations, but I do not respect him for this translation. Now he is very good, but the problem with translation work is that actually it is very, very difficult. When you translate, one of the problems with translation work, you try to have one word in English to be equivalent to one word in Pali language, and because the the words in Pali don't really overlap fully with the English words, right? Every word has kind of a range of meanings. The range of meanings in Pali is different from the range of meanings in a word in English. And because of that, sometimes you get very weird translations that don't really work out at all. And this is one of those cases where, frankly, it is very misleading what actually is translated here. And so it is very, very difficult to be a translator, so I never blame them, but that is often why it is useful to have different translations, different people explaining these things, because it gives you a different angle and it becomes clear what is going on. So the word here, covetousness and grief, the word is abhijja domanassa, is other words that I hear in Pali. And abhijja just means this desire related to the senses, to the five senses. So desire is really a perfectly valid translation here. Even sense desire or sensual desire would be perfectly right. Abhijja is a synonym for the word kama-chanda. Kama-chanda is one of the five hindrances on the path. And grief, domanasa. Domanasa means like an unpleasant mind state. It's a bit like aversion. Right? Aversion, the opposite of desire. It does not mean grief. Grief means sadness, right? You are grieving because you lost something very dear to you. That's what grief means. And this is completely, you don't grieve because you didn't get that cake over there or whatever, a piece of cake. That's a slightly too strong word for that. So, or maybe some people do, but they are pretty, they're not sure. But so grief is wrong. It means aversion. You feel have a negative reaction to one of the sense impacts on you. Sense impression, you have a negative impact on you, and that is called aversion. You have aversion to that thing that you're talking about. So desire and aversion, even like and dislike, perhaps even more straight to the point, right? Like and dislike, desire and aversion. These are here called the bad, unskillful, or bad, unwholesome qualities of the mind that we're trying to avoid. And because this is the mind being thrown around by the world, you go around and you see things and you like something and you're averse to something, and the mind is kind of jumping up and down all the time. You don't lack that evenness, and you lose your mindfulness all the time because the mind gets taken over by these powerful feelings and emotions inside of you. So you want to avoid that, and because you want to avoid that, it says here, the word here is invade that they have used here, and the Pali is anvasavati, anvasaveya, which can be translated in many different ways. It's important to, it doesn't really mean invade. It's not something which comes from the outside in. It's something that just arises inside of you. The potential for it to arise is already there inside of you. So the unwholesome states and covetousness and grief, they arise in him, might be a more kind of appropriate way of regarding this. So because of that, you practice the way of its restraint. You guard the eye faculty. You undertake the restraint of the eye faculty. Yeah. So now you know why you should restrain. You should not restrain. You should restrain because you want to avoid the like and dislike, the desire and aversion. That is what you want to avoid. So what do you do? Well, first of all, you guard the eye faculty. Yeah. What does that mean? It means that you are mindful. You are aware what is going on. That's what guarding means here. The mindfulness is always the guard of the mind. You see that anywhere in the suttas. One of the classic similes in the suttas is the simile of the fort. And with the simile of the fort, there's like a city inside, and there's kind of walls and ramparts and things on the outside. And there's one gate, right? And at that gate, there is a guard, and that guard is mindfulness. He stands at the gate. He only lets in the friends, and he keeps out the enemies. The enemies are the things that give rise to covetousness and grief. Well, that's why am I saying that word? Lack of mindfulness, right? The ones that give rise to desire and aversion, and the friends, that is everything that does not give rise to that. It is like mind, it's like calm and vipassana, calm and clear seeing, and that kind of stuff. That is what then gives rise to the positive states of mind. So that is what mindfulness does. It is the guard. You know what is happening. You know whether you are about to become angry, averse, negative, whether you're going to give rise to too much desire, all these kind of things. And so you stop yourself in time. You turn in a different direction. That is only the first part, right? The fact that you have to be mindful. But mindfulness is not enough. It is not just by standing back and kind of seeing that you're getting angry, getting angry, getting angry, getting desire, like that story I was told a couple of days ago about that woman, right, who had the guard at her house. Yeah, burglar leaving. Bye-bye, burglar. Yeah, that doesn't quite work, right? So we want to avoid the burglars to come into our mind, kind of steal our peace from us, because that is really what happens here. So that is the second part. Once you know that there is a problem, then you have to deal with it in the right way. And here, this dealing with it is called restraint. And we have to be very careful with these words in the English language, how they relate to the Pali, because the word restraint in English very often implies a use of willpower. Yeah, you restrain somebody, it means you hold them back by force usually. That's usually what it means. And the police restrains a terrorist or something like that. You hold the terrorist back. But that is not necessarily what it means here in the Pali. That is not the actual meaning of this. Restraint means restraint by any method by which you hold things back. Willpower can be used maybe occasionally. If you get completely overwhelmed and you want to kill somebody, okay, restraint, hold back. Yeah, you don't... that is just... At that point, you really have to kind of use a bit of willpower. But hopefully you don't get into that situation too often when you want to kill somebody. So most of the time, instead, we use a much more gentle technique. Not just gentle, but far more powerful technique than restraint. And that technique is called using wisdom. We talked about it already quite a bit. Yoniso manasikara, right? Wise attention. That is what you use in these situations. And so you know this is going to lead in the wrong way. And you ask yourself, how do I attend to this in a different way so that this problem doesn't arise? And once you learn some of these basic techniques of how to attend in the right way, it shifts. And as you do that, bang, the state disappears as a consequence of that. And that is the right way of restraining these things. I will show you how this actually works in practice as we continue on with this one. That is basically how it works. I'm not going to go into any more details right now because I'm going to talk about it much more afterwards. That gives you a rough idea of sense restraint. It's about using wisdom ideally, and only in really dire circumstances do you actually use willpower. And then we have the same thing spoken for all the other senses as well. It goes as follows: on hearing a sound with the ear, on smelling an odor with the nose, on tasting a flavor with the tongue, on touching a tangible with the body, on cognizing a mind object with the mind. He does not grasp at its signs and features, since if he left the mind faculty unguarded, the bad, unskillful qualities of desire and aversion might arise in him. Because of that, he practices the way of wisdom power. He guards the mind faculty with mindfulness. He undertakes the restraint by wisdom power of the mind faculty. And possessing this noble restraint of the faculties, he experiences within himself a bliss that is unsullied, or the bliss of unsulliedness. Abhyaseka sukha is the Pali word for that. Now, second stage of bliss, right? We already had the bliss of blamelessness. Now you move up the ladder to one higher degree of bliss, the bliss that is unsullied. and it's unsullied, because when you have the bliss of blamelessness, because the mind is still has these qualities in it of desire and aversion, it's as if it is slightly besmirched by the mind still having these negative qualities. But once the mind gets purified, it is not sullied or soiled anymore by these negative qualities. It has greater degree of purity, and then you experience within yourself, as a consequence, a higher degree of bliss. So this is what we mean here again by sila, right? Sila becoming more powerful. We develop the sila through many stages. First of all, it's just the sila of body and speech. Now you're developing the sila of mind, and if you include that, the happiness as a consequence becomes more powerful. And of course, what that means is that the more you practice the sila, the deeper you take the sila, the more aspects of sila you include within your practice, the longer you do it for, so it becomes really stable and really solid, then the more ability you will have to meditate as a consequence. Because meditation always is caused by sila, conditioned by your sila. And this is, in a sense, what you're seeing here with this restraint of the sense faculties. So that is the passage for you on the restraint of the sense faculties. And what I would like to do is really to talk now in more detail about that. But before I do that, maybe it is useful to have a look at this next passage here, first of all, because it's very, very much related to this. And this is the passage on sampajanya, on clear awareness. We've already been talking about this quite a bit, but this is the standard way in which clear awareness, or full awareness, or clear comprehension, or what you want to call it, this is the standard way. This is talked about in the suttas. So maybe that is maybe we should go there first before we actually go to details of sense restraint. So this is how this goes. So this is like just another way of looking at sense restraint, in a sense. This kind of just expands a little bit on that topic. So he is one who acts in full awareness when going forward and returning. Who acts in full awareness when looking ahead and looking away. Who acts in full awareness when flexing and extending his limbs. Who acts in full awareness when wearing his robes and carrying his outer robe and bowl. Who acts in full awareness when eating, drinking, consuming food and tasting. Who acts in full awareness when defecating and urinating. Who acts in full awareness when walking, standing, sitting, sleeping, being awake, talking, and keeping silent. So this is the standard passage of full awareness, and it may look like a weird kind of combination of things. What do these things have to do with each other, all of these things? What they have to do with each other, these are essentially those things. Remember, we're talking about the monastic path here. These are essentially the things that a monastic does outside of meditation practice. Yeah? So a lot of the things that you see here have to do with, like, going into the village to receive your alms food, looking ahead, looking away, extending and flexing your limbs, all that. That has to do with kind of going on alms round and receiving your alms food. The same thing with carrying your bowl, etc. And of course, all the things about eating is also included in there. And then at the very end, things like the kind of things that you have to do in life, sleeping and being awake and talking and all that kind of stuff is also included in there. So basically, these are the things that we do in life outside of meditation practice. And of course, you can expand this also to lay life. The idea is to have as much awareness as possible in all your activities, whatever you do. This, to my mind, is not yet Satipatthana practice, but it is just a way of making sure that you keep your mind nice and pure. You don't allow it to kind of get sullied by too many defilements. You have full awareness of what is going on in all of these activities. So full awareness, sampajanya, what does it really mean? What is the point of all of this? And the point of all of this, full awareness, is usually explained in the commentaries as four factors. And I think these are quite useful way of looking at full awareness. I already talked about those a little bit before, the ideas of purpose, of suitability. In the commentaries, they also extend this to gochara, which gochara means gochara means like the field or the you know where you hang out, so to speak. Yeah. Like the gochara is literally where the cows go. So it means the fields. So what is your field of movement with your mind, right? What is that field? That is the gochara. And the last one is asamoha, which is non-delusion, is the fourth aspect here of full awareness that you find in the commentaries. But of those, the first two are by far the most practical ones and the ones that are most useful, especially early on the path. So you know the purpose, yeah? So if you are a monastic, when you go into the village, you go into the village to receive alms. You don't go into the village to see all the nice things, right? Have a look at all the young women wandering around or whatever it is, or the nice cars, or the latest Ferrari. Look, check it out, right? That is not the point. You know why you are doing something, and you go into the village for that purpose, and you know straight away. You know if your mind is going in the wrong direction or heading in the right way. And then there is the idea of suitability, which is very closely related to that. Is it yes? You go to the village for this, you go into the village. It may have been the right purpose, but is it a suitable time? Maybe there's some problem there which will hinder you in these things. And in exactly the same way as, in life, we ask ourselves, how I live my life, is it suitable? Is it purposeful? How often do I need to go to the casino? I know that nobody here probably ever goes to the casino very much, but, you know, this is kind of the way you think, right? Do I really need to go to the casino again? I was there last week. Maybe this is enough. Something like that. And the casinos, I have been to casinos. I remember being to a casino even after I became a monk. I was in Macau, you know, close to Hong Kong. My parents were kind of taking me around, and we decided, well, let's have a look at these casinos just to get the feeling for them. So I never actually went into the game floor. I just went into the other parts of the casino, and it was one of the worst experiences of my life. It felt so incredibly oppressive and so kind of... I don't know, it's a very negative experience. I don't know why anyone would ever want to go to casinos. It's almost the opposite of living the spiritual life. It's kind of this darkness full of kind of people trying to draw you into the gaming room. Everything was about kind of getting you to play the roulette. Usually you play kind of these games in the evening, right? That's when people kind of come out and want to go to the casino. So inside this enormous, it was the biggest casino in the world at the time, the Venetian it was called. And inside, the atmosphere is always evening time, right? It's always like little stars in the sky and that kind of thing. So almost kind of to draw you towards the games room and start playing the roulette or the blackjack or whatever it is. It was a very negative feeling. And so you are aware of that. You know what feelings certain things actually give rise to. You are aware of what is going on. And it was actually very nice to be a monk in the casino, because I didn't really want to have a monk there. So I was kind of ushered through the back alleys, right? Monks are bad luck in the casino. They're not supposed to be there. So it was quite good. So this is how you are. You have that awareness of how you live your life, right? How much TV do you want to watch? Well, okay, watch a little bit of TV, but you watch things that are more useful and that kind of stuff. And this is the full awareness, to know how things affect you. Are you fulfilling the purpose of the path? Is it suitable to fulfill that purpose? And then you do things in that way. And some of the interesting things here, just to have just a couple of things that are interesting here. I did mention them before, but I'll mention them again. One of them is here, it talks about falling asleep, right? The Pali word is sutta, and it talks about waking up, jagariya, how does that pronounce? Jagariya, I'm not sure. This is actually not what these words mean. What they actually mean, sutta actually means asleep. So for one who acts in fullness, when asleep this would be, or when being awake. And this doesn't make any sense because you don't have full awareness when you are asleep. So the right way of translating this whole passage actually should be slightly different. This is how I think this whole passage should be translated. You are one who acts in fullness, in full awareness, in regard to going forward and returning. It's not so much that you have full awareness while you do these things, but you have full awareness about these things. You know why you're going forward, why you are returning. You're fulfilling the purpose and the suitability of these acts. You act in full awareness in regard to looking ahead and looking away. You know why you are doing that. You're looking out to see if the people will want to give you some alms food, right? If you just walk past looking down, if people want to give you something, that will be very rude as well. So you have to look up a little bit and see what's going on. Flexing and extending your limbs again in regard to that. And that is why you see that it actually starts to make sense. You act, the last one then becomes, you act in full awareness in regard to walking, standing, sitting, being asleep, being awake, in regard to talking, and in regard to keeping silent. So you know how much you're supposed to talk. You have full awareness about that. You know when it's right to be awake. You know when it's right to be asleep, etc. And in this way, you have full awareness. You have sampajanya about these things. So bring that idea into your life a little bit, the idea of purpose and suitability. And it is actually a very nice way of thinking about things. And when you think about things in that way, I think it can be a great way of going faster on this path. And this, of course, is just an aspect of the sense restraint that we had looking at before. And we can see how all of this is very closely related to the idea of wisdom, rather than the idea of forcing yourself this way or that way. Okay, so that is the little passage on clear comprehension. And it comes before Satipatthana. It is not really, I think, a part of Satipatthana. But what I will do now, I'm going to skip the rest of this sutta. And I will come back to the rest of the sutta later on. But the next thing I want to have a look at is the sutta called the Two Kinds of Thought. And that comes up. And that will be coming up tomorrow morning. I'm not going to continue now because it will just be too much. That is going to be the next one. And this is all in more detail about the idea of sense restraint, how to deal with the mind, how to push, kind of gently encourage the mind in the right direction is what this is all about. So that is all for now, and we'll see you again at 7:30 this evening here.